In 1971, two young women are on their way to a party outside Vermilion. They never arrive. From SDPB, today is Thursday, April 3rd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, this year's Siouxland One book is Vanished in Vermilion. It's the story of one of South Dakota's most famous cold cases. Two high school juniors disappear. The local sheriff suspects they ran away, but the families know that cannot be true. What follows is decades of agony and delayed grief. We'll discuss a police investigation desperately seeking justice that takes a series of wrong turns in search for the suspect. And we'll explore the impact on a family of the man accused of a crime that never happened, but whose other crimes had neighbors frustrated and unnerved. Author Lou Ragus is with us. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Before we get to today's show, this is SDPB's Spring Member Drive. And joining me in the studio today is In the Moment producer, Ari Youngeman. Hey, Ari.
Hi, Lori.
All right. On public radio, we bring you stories and conversations that make you stop and think, sometimes even change your view of the world. So today we are going to pull back the curtain just a little bit to give you a look at how these trusted stories come to air, brought to you by South Dakota journalists like Ari. Ari, this In the Moment hour really started with you when we had a meeting and you brought this idea to the table for the full team to discuss. Where did it begin for you? When did you come up with this idea?
So I found this idea when I was researching on the Siouxland Library's website, and I saw that they were announcing their Siouxland One Book kickoff, and I noticed that there was a big event that was going to be happening. And so I read through the details, and I noticed that there were several speakers that were going to be part of this kickoff that we had talked to before, and they were bringing forth really interesting stories. And I thought, I want to know more about this, and I would guess other people do too. So let's take a deeper look into this.
Yeah. So the whole team said yes, and then you start planning. Help people understand how much planning goes. So you're sending invitations, you're doing research, you're sending emails, you're talking to people. What goes into planning an hour like this for you?
Oh boy, a lot of contact. So we started off by getting a hold of Siouxland Libraries and really connecting and working with them to bring their speakers into SDPB and get a deeper look into what kind of programming they were bringing to the community as well. And from there, I was reaching out to the authors and the podcasters and taking a look at what they were talking about and what their research really was.
So then you pass all that research off to me, and Ellen is part, we'll talk to Ellen a little bit later in the hour, but she's part of all this. Even though the idea might start with one producer, the whole team jumps in to do the work. The research comes to me. I read the book. I read your research that you've given me. I do a little bit of my own research. I do the interviews, and then I give the interviews back to you, and you get to listen through and do some editing. I'm just curious, because we have not talked about this, what stood out to you in some of these interviews once you got to hear the tape?
It brought across a viewpoint that I had not really given as much thought to prior to this. And so that's the view that there are so many unintended consequences and people that are impacted beyond oftentimes the original scope of the case. So looking at people whose lives were impacted for years to come and the unintended consequences that came from these events.
Yeah. As our spring membership drive, we want to remind you, you can support local stories like this with a donation to SDPB today. Go online, sdpb.org, or give us a call, 605-443-6963. Thanks, Ari. Siouxland Libraries is kicking off its 2025 One Book Siouxland program this weekend. Branch librarian and One Book organizer Kim Koblank joins me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls for a look behind the scenes at the book selection and program planning.
Well, it was an interesting conversation. We had four finalists for our shortlist when we met last August, and so many of the people that were on the committee either were journalists or worked in journalism or were so familiar with the case that when they read the book, they found out so many more things that they didn't know about. And they also liked how Lou wrote the book and the local tie and just being able to recognize a lot of the people that played a part in this story.
Yeah. We're going to talk to Lou later in the hour. It's a fascinating conversation. But the programming that you have around this is really compelling as well.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about how you built it out for context.
So when we discuss the books to select it for the One Book Ultimate Selection, we always talk about programming and how can we bring people together to talk about the book. And when we were talking about this with the theme of the girls missing for so long, missing murdered Indigenous women came to mind, so we knew we wanted to do programming on that. And then we also wanted to do programming on crime reporting and evidence gathering and just some of those things that people don't really usually get to be in the room with the experts so they can ask the questions they've always wanted to ask.
Yeah. All right. So we'll put some links up on our website so people can find everything that they need to find. What sort of responses are you having about the book and the programming so far?
People are really enjoying it. Yeah. I was curious, with it being a true crime book, how many people were going to be interested in it or if it was going to be too salacious or not. But people have really enjoyed it, and they are big fans. We have a lot of book groups in town that look forward to one book every year, and they read the book, and then sometimes they'll skip a month to just go to all the programming instead of having another discussion.
Yeah. For libraries across the state who are planning their own, you know, community one books, their own programming plans, how do you guys work together and like feed off? Do you talk to librarians across the state? Do you connect with them on social media or?
I'm going to be doing a conference presentation with the one in Aberdeen. Kara Parian does the All Aberdeen Reads, and they just did their big discussion last week. I can't recall the book, but it was on disabled persons, and yeah, so we're going to work together, and so hopefully building that relationship we'll be able to work together more. But right now it's just kind of our solo effort with hopes to branch out to the other libraries in the state.
And you mentioned you're reading it for the second time now.
Yep, I'm reading it for the second time. I'm leading a couple book discussions in a couple weeks, so I wanted to be refreshed.
Yeah. What are you picking up the second time that the first time maybe you missed?
Just kind of the personalities of all the people involved a little more. Now that I know the story, I can pay attention a little bit more to what the responses were like from the Licken family. Hearing, because I'm listening to it, hearing Lou read it and how he portrays Kerwin and the conversations I've had with him to hear like what he's like as a person and his relationship with him. And it kind of, you know, brings him to me as a real person. Now I can understand who he is and what happened to his family.
Yeah, I asked that when I went to check out my copy of the book. The librarian there said, oh, it's an audiobook too. And I said, who reads it? And I didn't know the answer, but Lou Ragus reads it as well. So, hey, if you have a library card, the world is open to you. That's Siouxland Library Branch Librarian and One Book Siouxland Organizer Kim Koblank. You can find out more details about the upcoming programming at the Siouxland Library website. Coming up next, we'll preview more of the One Book Siouxland kickoff with Vanished in Vermilion author Lou Ragus. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The One Book Siouxland choice for 2025 centers on a South Dakota cold case from 1971. Vanished in Vermilion tells the story of high school juniors Pam Jackson and Sherry Miller. Author Lou Ragus joined me for a conversation about the book. We dive into law enforcement response, public perspective, and the consequences of an investigation that impacted the lives of everyone involved. A note to listeners, this conversation does include references that some may find distressing, including talk of death, abduction, and rape.
Yeah, so I graduated from the University of Minnesota in 2005, and I started in Sioux Falls at Kelloland News, my first job out of college. And at that time, I was assigned the Cops and Courts beat. And so that's where I developed my interest in covering crime stories and court stories. I was in South Dakota for 3 years, moved on to Tucson, Arizona, and then Buffalo, New York. And then 10 years ago now, in 2015, I moved back to Minnesota, where I'm from originally, and started working at the NBC affiliate CARE 11.
Before we get into the case itself, what made you want to revisit this case in book length form?
Well, I stayed in contact with Pam and Sherry's family members, particularly Pam Jackson's brother-in-law, her sister's husband from Sioux Falls. I became so close with him that when my wife and I got married in 2010, which was already 2 years after leaving South Dakota, we invited them to our wedding. So that's how close I got with them. And so I was always, you know, when I'd call and catch up, you know, this was the topic of conversation. And so when it finally, you know, when the Studebaker was found in Brule Creek, Dexter called me. I was like his first phone call. Mm. And I actually called back to Kelloland to let them know to get down there. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's how still into it I was. And then when all the information came out, I really wasn't satisfied with my personal questions weren't answered. And as I talked with the family, they really didn't know what to think, because even though it was presented to them that this was a car accident, most likely, they didn't have that definitive feel. And so they wondered, is there more here? Like, why did they blame David Licken for so long for murdering these girls? Like, what led them down that path? And there were just so many unanswered questions. And then they wanted something put into writing for them to pass down in their family, because newspaper articles at that point didn't make sense anymore because of all the misinformation that came out. And then I said, well, if you are willing to bear with me, I can put this into a book form and really get to the truth of everything.
Wow. All right. So for people who didn't follow this, it begins in 1971 when these two young women, Pam Jackson and Sherry Miller, 17 years old, just sort of disappear. They're in a car on the way to a party, and then they're gone. And part of what makes this a challenging case is the law enforcement response at the beginning, which is a theme of the book being, you know, the narrative that we tell about the case leads us to certain questions that we ask or assumptions that authorities make. And that can lead people down the wrong road. So tell us a little bit about what happened, some of the things that you learned about what happened in 1971 that perhaps contributed to the, you know, the sheriff locally not looking very hard. What was the culture like then?
Yeah, it was a major culture problem when girls would be gone, you know, maybe for a day. There would be a thought that it was a rebellious, you know, running away. You know, it was a lot of counterculture still into 1971, you know, coming from the late 60s. There were hippie communes around the area, including in Winnipeg, Canada, where one girl from Vermilion did run away to. But the difference there was she mailed a letter to her parents right away and let her know where she was and what she was doing there. And the sheriff just had this attitude that they must have run away. And then even, you know, when there's just no evidence showing that they would have done that, their bank accounts are still filled with money. You know, they a dying grandmother's in the hospital. It just took so long to even acknowledge that that probably didn't happen. And then there was just no, like, classic investigation 101 done. Not all the people that saw them on the last day were interviewed. Mm-hmm. And no records were taken of what had and had not been done, so that later on when people would pick it up, they wouldn't know. And then so eventually when some of those law enforcement officials either left office or passed away, nobody really knew it was done. So it was eye-opening to me. You know, I guess I knew that there was no good investigation done, but it was eye-opening to me that they really didn't have any leads at all, including they didn't have a note that said, David Licken is suspicious. Like, I always assume that they returned to this David Licken, who was the same age as them and lived in the same area where they were last seen, in the same area where they were trying to get to this party on Memorial Day weekend, 1971. I assume that there was some sort of suspicion from 1971 that made them revisit it decades later, but there really wasn't.
No. How important is this article in 1991 by reporter Randall Hunhoff in the Vermilion Plain Talk? How important is that to the, you know, it's 20 years later he revisits the case.
Yeah, I mean, like, these days, that happens all the time where it's an anniversary, so the local news will do an anniversary article to raise a spotlight on an old case. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen like it does now. That was very rare. So Randall Hunhoff heard about this case because he happened to be drinking in the bar where Sherry Miller's mom worked, and he got an interest in it. He did his own investigating, and he basically interviewed people that police had never interviewed before. And all of a sudden, that raised interest not just in the public about what happened to Pam and Sherry, but also with law enforcement.
Yeah.
And so this article became a piece of the case file that they would refer to just like any other evidence. And that essentially laid the groundwork for a cold case unit to pick it up a few years later.
Yeah, when there is a cold case unit. Did you notice in Hunhoff's reporting any particular narrative that he had laid out that provided leads or, misleads? For people who were covering it later.
The most important thing about Randall's article was that he interviewed Mark Lanterman, which was, so when Pam and Sherry, they disappeared, the last people to see them alive were these three classmates who were also trying to get to the same party. They drove up and found them at a rural church, and these three boys said, okay, follow us there. Well, police only interviewed one or possibly two out of those three boys. One of them passed away a few, somewhere in between, so we don't know if he was talked to or not. Randall interviewed all three of them.
Yeah.
And what I learned from that is that the one that police had relied on had the foggiest memory and gave police the incorrect, not intentionally, but gave police the incorrect route that they took to drive to the party. And the incorrect route in which they noticed the girls were no longer behind them. So using that one boy's, now man's story, police thought that it put the girls on the path of David Licken's house. And so it added more plausibility to their theory that David Licken must have done something to them. If police had interviewed Mark Lagerman, they would have learned that the girls, they noticed they were missing, essentially at the place where they eventually were found.
Right.
So Mark Lagerman's information in hindsight was so important. And then the other thing about Randall Hunhoff's article is that he really went after the theory that they had driven into the water.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't really go down the path of, like, that they were murdered. Like, it was raised as a possibility in the article, but that wasn't his focus. And he was so, thinking that they might have driven into the Missouri River, that Randall actually went out on his own boat looking in the water to see if he could find tires poking up anywhere in the Missouri.
Wow. And Mark doesn't know that. I mean, Mark is indignant that nobody asked him, but he assumed that they had all the information from Steve. He doesn't know that Steve's memory was different than his until
Mark moved to California. So he had this level of separation,
right,
where it's like, yeah, when he heard from Randall, he didn't know that no investigation had been done in this. And then even after that, he never got a copy of the article. So it was published in the Vermilion Plain Talk newspaper and then again in South Dakota Magazine, but he didn't get that back in California.
Right.
So, and nobody had mailed it to him. So he didn't even know the contradictions that Randall had found. All he knew is that what he told Randall when he was interviewed. Yeah. So it wasn't until many years later that Mark found out that police had screwed all this up.
Yeah. So, all right, let's talk about when this becomes a cold case and when David Licken becomes a person of interest at all. He's already incarcerated when officers start thinking he might have something to do with it.
Yeah. So in 2004, the state of South Dakota opened its own cold case unit, and this was happening all over the country at that time. And then culturally, the show CSI was so popular, and it all had to do with the rise of DNA technology and how that was able to help solve cases where there was a piece of evidence sitting on the shelf for decades that just needed to be retested and figure out who it belonged to. And the irony here is that they didn't have any physical evidence in Pam and Sherry's disappearance, so they didn't have anything to test for DNA. So regardless of that, they chose Pam and Sherry's case to be one of the very first ones that they investigate because they had developed this theory that David Licken, who was convicted and sentenced to decades, actually hundreds of years in prison for some rapes that he had committed, he came across as a good suspect. And I think anyone would agree that they needed to look into him because of his proximity to it and the crimes that he had ended up committing later. But then that whole idea kind of turned it into a classic case of confirmation bias, where anything that they found after that, they found a way to fit it into their David Licken theory rather than going where the evidence led them.
There is a pattern as well, where it seems to me throughout the book, the people who come at the story with fresh eyes are often the ones who see something that no one has seen before, whereas the people who have been working again and again and diligently, Special Agent Braley, for example, sometimes they are missing things that somebody new comes in and says, no, that I can easily poke a hole in that. Is that consistent with other cases that you've covered in your reporting throughout time, that there can be a pattern? It helps to have somebody from the outside try to poke holes in a theory that you have or look at something anew?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mentioned the kidnapping of Jacob Wetterling, which was one of Minnesota's biggest mysteries of all time.
Yeah.
When they finally had the FBI do a full case review, which means going from the beginning and reading everything from the first report going forward, and then giving a new theory or a new lead to look into. Once they did that, they pointed at the correct suspect, ended up being the correct suspect, which was actually the first suspect that the local authorities had developed in that case. The problem, you know, with the local authorities is they couldn't, you know, prove it against their initial suspect. So then they moved on to another suspect. And then that's when they started finding, you know, suspicious things about a new suspect that's actually innocent. Mm-hmm. And so when the fresh eyes came in, they're like, no. Why did we ever get past this first guy? And that's how they solved that case. And I think that happens a lot when they do these full case reviews. The problem is it's so labor intensive that how many, you know, local departments can afford to do that,
right,
both time and money wise. And that's why it doesn't happen as much as it probably should.
Yeah.
So again, with the Pam and Sherry case, it's like, if you talk to the investigators, like the ones who ended up, you know, digging out the Studebaker, like they all have a good idea, like, of how this happened, because they're looking at it objectively.
Right.
But those initial cold case investigators, their view on it is still jaded.
Yeah. The lawyers who defend David Licken very quickly see the problems with the case. They swiftly come to a different conclusion. Mike Butler,
absolutely,
and Clint Sargent. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the impact on the Licken family and the Licken farm of being, because people think, well, David Lycan's already incarcerated. He was never going to get out. So what can the consequences be of him being potentially accused but never, you know, tried or you know, with this murder that he did not commit, because it was not a murder? But there are pretty intense consequences for him and for his family.
Yeah, so when he was sentenced in 1990, David Licken received a 225-year sentence for a series of horrible rapes that he did. His family continued to live on the farm that he grew up on, and fast forward to 2004, when the cold case reopened, his brother Kerwin lived in a house on the original farmstead, and then his 84-year-old mother, Esther, lived in another house there, and then his sister-in-law lived on a third house there. So there actually were three separate houses on this farmstead with people living in them. And, you know, just like it, I mean, just like in any small town, like the way that the rumor mill works, like once the authorities descended on there, it essentially, the story was that this was a family of murderers that had done this to Pam and Sherry, and then potentially many more. And there were, you know, other theories that were coming forward that they were involved in this case and that case. And, you know, when you're talking about the 84-year-old mother, she suffered PTSD and continued anxiety that anytime somebody knocked on her door, that it was the agents coming back to search some more. So I think I illustrated in the book very well, you know, the effect that it had on them.
Yeah. And you also sit face to face with the brother who says, you were one of the people as a journalist who made my life miserable. And you, as a reporter, have to face some of the questions that you didn't ask and some of the ways that you cover some of the questions that you did ask. How did you process that?
Well, at first, you know, I was a little defensive, I guess, because so in the way that I wrote the book was the third part, for anyone that hasn't read it, is where I kind of bring myself into it in the first person a little bit more, because it's a little more of my first person reporting and leading us towards, you know, what really happened here.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that was I knew that Kerwin Lincoln was upset with me, obviously, over the years, because you had many phone calls where you'd hang up and so forth. But in my mind, you know, all I was doing was I was reporting what people were saying. Like, if they said one thing and he said another thing, I would report both and cite my sources. And that was the job of a reporter. But, you know, I guess once I started thinking about it a little more, it's like, you know, just going back to, there was a jailhouse informant who provided evidence that claiming that David Licken had confessed to him in the prison. And that's what they told us, and that's what I reported. But I didn't think to ask things like, well, was it video recorded? Which it wasn't. Were there prison guards watching this conversation who can corroborate it? No, there weren't. And so I realized, you know, like, I could have been more skeptical in the information I'm receiving, with the information I'm receiving, by asking more skeptical questions.
Yeah.
And then by not doing that, yes, I continued. I gave full credence to the theories that are being put out there, just in my, what I thought was basic reporting. And I think once I acknowledged that to Kerwin and apologized to him for the role that I played, then it really opened up, you know, the getting everything from him as far as his story and how it affected his family.
As you're doing this book, though, you have a very hard time getting the police reports and getting all the information because of South Dakota's sunshine laws, which it's really hard for you to get this story even now after everything is over. Tell us a little bit about that. And then, do you think if you had asked those questions, you would have gotten any different answers? Because there's plenty of things that law enforcement did not reveal to the public that were printed, that were maybe misleading and were never corrected by authorities either.
Yeah, there's a saying, you don't know what you don't know. Yeah. And that makes it really hard. Like, everything's easier in hindsight. In South Dakota, people don't realize the sunshine laws, which means your access to public records is much more limited than it is in other states. And Minnesota does not have the best sunshine laws, but I'll just use it as a comparison. When a case is closed, meaning, you know, the person has either been tried and convicted or found not guilty, or even if they decide not to file charges and a charging decision is made, a case gets closed, the public can request, through a data request, all of the police reports, the photographs, even the interviews. And they go through and they make redactions on, you know, any sort of like financial information or social security numbers and so forth. But other than that, you can get all of that stuff and basically review what was done and basically check the work of police and check that they were telling the truth and how they presented it, like all of those things. Mm-hmm. And we do that on major cases here or on controversial cases. And in South Dakota, they can release police reports if they want, or they could keep them secret if they want. It's as simple as that. And that was frustrating because at the time that I requested them, the disappearance of Pam and Sherry was not even a crime anymore. Right. It was an accident. And so how is this a criminal? Well, according to South Dakota sunshine laws, it's a criminal record if it ever was investigated as a crime. And so, you know, I'm up against these technicalities that are just absurd to me. And it wasn't until Marty Jackley left office as Attorney General the first time and Roundsburg took over, that I went to Roundsburg and I said, hey, I've been having trouble getting these records. The families of the victims of Pam and Sherry want them. Can I come to you with, you know, a letter from them saying that that I'm working on this book and they want the truth, that you would let it happen? And he did let it happen.
You mentioned, you know, that this in the end is not a crime, it's an accident. And then you do an excellent job near the end of the book of pointing out that not everybody believes it was an accident even today. So narratives take hold and they stay there. What's going on? And there's some fine points in this where I think, as you know, put at one point a transcript of a conversation that you have with Trevor Jones, and you can hear, I think, him saying, you know, at the time we were following these things and we were making the decisions that you would make. We have to follow the leads. We have to, if someone says something is buried here and I saw it, we have to dig. But you're saying to him, but in retrospect, that was not true at all, because we know for a fact that the car was always here. Some people are like, maybe, maybe not. What's going on there?
There's a lot to unpack there. And that is a part of the book where I did not trim it down because I wanted everybody to be able to read all of that and process it. So backing up, when I started working on the story, I already knew that there were people in the area that still thought the Lickens had killed these girls.
Yeah.
And so the current sheriff, Andy Howe of Clay County in Vermilion, is a great guy. He was not involved in, you know, the bad stuff that happened in this case. I told him that, and he was like, no way. There aren't people. No, that's not. Well, after the book came out, he called me up and he said, hey, I'd like to talk to you about the book a little bit. You know, great job. And second of all, I just had somebody who came in here who said, I read that book and I still think the Lickens did it. And he was flabbergasted, but it just kind of proved the point of how these narratives take hold. I think, though, that the book, you know, has gone a long way to helping people see that that wasn't the case. As far as Trevor Jones goes, so he was one of the original cold case investigators and obviously went on to big things beyond the DCI in the state of South Dakota. What he said to me was, if the car never would have been found in the creek, then our theory might have been the truth. And so he was basically, but I said, the truth is the truth. And he said, well, now in hindsight it is, but if we didn't know that, then maybe our theory was the truth. And so it was like, to me, it just didn't make sense, because to me, the truth is the truth, not like the most likely version of what happened, right? And so he was unable to change his original viewpoint, even when faced with cold, hard facts.
Yeah.
And that just, I had a hard time wrapping my head around that. And then another finer point to go into there is, like he pointed out, we had to follow the leads. If somebody says there's a car buried here, we got to go find it.
Right.
I'm like, you're right, you do. However, those leads did not come to you. You created those leads, because it was David Licken's sister that told them there was a car buried there, but she didn't initially. They went and interviewed her, and she said, no, absolutely not. Then they kept going after her and giving suggestive information, and she's, you know, if you read the book, she's a mentally vulnerable person. Eventually, she started having memories that came back to her. You know, like, I think anybody who has done any research in police interviewing techniques would see a gazillion red flags with how they handled her. And I go into detail in one chapter on how false memories are formed in these police interviews and so forth. Once she started coming out with this information, it was like they just finally got what they wanted after these suggestive hypnosis and other techniques were used.
Yeah, I feel like this case and how the investigation and interviews were done is a case study for many law enforcement officers to think about how they interview, how they interrogate, the questions they ask, the answers that they want to hear, the answers that they hear. It has to be studied in law enforcement circles. And to the point of the stress, you know, that it provides on the Licken family and the family of Sherry and Pam, Mike Braley also dies shortly after the investigation of this, and possibly his life is shortened by the stress. That's hard to prove, but he has an aneurysm. The stress from the law on the law enforcement perspective, what I'm saying, is also incredibly intense. This is a really painful story for a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. And his son was the one that told me that, you know, he thought it was a stress-induced brain aneurysm that his father died from. Not only that, but the community, because when you're left with, you know, an open-ended question, I think I learned a lot about human nature with my research in this book. And one major part of human nature is that we want answers, and unanswered questions are difficult for people to deal with, and people deal with them in different ways. And I think just the community at large being left with unanswered questions after the cold case fell apart in 2008, I think that was hard. And then finally, you know, 2013, 2014, they started to get answers. And then I think finally the book helps, you know, finally answer any remaining questions.
Yeah. What does justice look like in this case then?
I think justice looks like that Pam and Sherry's, you know, lives can be, you know, finally celebrated and grieved. And, you know, they can be remembered for the joy that they brought to people in their 17 years. And that the Licken family can be left alone in regards to this case. If they're owed an apology, they can be given an apology. And, you know, David Licken can continue to serve his sentence for the crimes that he actually did commit. And then life can go on.
That was One Book Siouxland author Lou Ragus. Ragus will speak about his book, Vanished in Vermilion, at the Sioux Falls Convention Center on April 24th. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. The author talk begins at 7 p.m. local time with a presentation by Ragus, followed by a Q&A and a book signing. The event is for adults 18 and older, and registration is required. After the break, we welcome podcaster and historian Local Lou. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to go back a little further in time now to take a look into another local historical crime. Podcaster and historian Local Lou joins me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. She is presenting at the One Book Siouxland kickoff event this weekend. You can hear her presentation on the Court of Public Opinion at 10 a.m. at the Downtown Library in Sioux Falls. She gives us a preview of the presentation now.
I'm going to have the Court of Public Opinion. We're going to be in session. We have some things to discuss, guys.
Yes. Like,
I have a couple just local historical crimes. They date from 1880 to 1973. So, you know, and that isn't necessarily going to be like... it's not necessarily going to be wrongly accused and, you know, everybody got it wrong, but it's just going to be that there's two crimes where we kind of know who did these.
Right.
It just means that there's maybe some things that are misunderstood or misconstrued or pieces of the story that got blown so far away from fact.
Right.
It just, those things get ingrained in towns. Like,
yeah.
That kind of rumor has it mentality, it is hard to kick. And there are tons of little pieces of our history that get lost that way. So I just kind of want to talk about that kind of disease of yellow journalism, right?
Sure.
That clickbait that we have going around, that's not new. And so a lot of these trials and situations had quite a bit of kind of clickbait going on.
Yeah, that sensationalism
yes.
of the time where there's a headline that's really big and bold with exclamation, exclamation point, and the language that's used in some of the newspaper coverage at the time can be shocking. Tell us one of the stories that you've been diving into for your presentation.
Absolutely. So one of them is the Kaufman House mystery. So that is a historical marker, and it's on Summit and 7th in downtown Sioux Falls. And it talks about Moses and Emma Kaufman. Moses was a kind of hoity-toity guy. He owned was one of the owners of the Sioux Falls Brewery, which is just a couple blocks away from here. And his wife is a part of Sioux Falls Society. And in 1906, they hire a servant girl. She's 16 years old. She's from Austria-Hungary. She had just immigrated to Parkston, South Dakota with her family. This job is a big deal. It's a big deal for her and her family. She's going to leave Parkston, move to Sioux Falls, and be their live-in maid. And she only gets to be their live-in maid for about 3 months before she dies under really weird circumstances. And this is one of those where we have facts, and it does appear that Emma Kaufman is directly related to the event that causes this girl's death.
Right.
However, the news coverage of this was so sensationalized. It was so big. It was so flamboyant. And I felt like the shade of yellow of the journalism, the further away from Sioux Falls you got, the darker yellow it became. So, like, in Sioux Falls on, I think it was like June 20th, 1906, there's a headline that's talking about a big crowd gathers for her first court appearance. And, you know, there's hissing and the women are mad and everyone's mad at this lady because she killed her servant. And it's awful. But then Minneapolis, their headline is angry mob screams lynch her.
Oh,
and then when you read far down in the article, they say that a couple people in the crowd are heard saying lynch her. And it's like, okay. So yeah. A little
and
different.
That colors the entire narrative.
Yes.
Of this case of what happened to Agnes. Wayne Fanavest, of course, wrote a book called No Justice for Agnes.
Yes.
What did we learn about the impact of this on justice?
You know, justice in this case, there's a reason the book is called No Justice for Agnes, right? Like, I don't know what justice would have looked like. Probably would have looked like maybe an apology to the family, maybe some kind of acknowledgement of wrongdoing. And that's not going to happen. Emma does get sentenced and is found guilty. However, the prosecuting attorney, George Egan, was found guilty of misconduct. And so then she gets to get tried again. And then she gets that little slap on the wrist that a lady of society deserves. And she just scampers away and lives a couple more years of life before she dies. I think her husband dies first and then she dies. I think within, maybe 6 or 7 years of this. So it's not like she goes on and lives like some amazing life or anything, but I felt like it showed, I think it was a lesson for Sioux Falls, really, because it started with, they didn't even put her in jail. They let her go home because the jail was awful. And it's like, okay, but she might
She's
have killed
charged
somebody.
With yes this yeah
yeah mm-hmm. And so it's like, okay, so work on your jail, cool, but also we need to not let her go home to her mansion because she might have actually killed this person. She is charged, it's going to be a trial. The trial does get moved from Sioux Falls to Flandreau. The judge, there's a couple different articles in the paper where the judge is like doing like a public plea to like wait until the trial, guys. Like, let's keep
innocent
cool heads.
Until proven guilty. Wait until the facts come out. And that's not always easy to do.
It isn't. But at the same time, like, as a person of John Q. Public or whatever, like, I guess I have to say, I don't think I could survive a trial by rumor. I don't think other people would either. I feel like it would be a very, I don't even know if Mother Teresa could. I've read her book. Like, I think
trial by social media.
Yes.
Trial by headline. And like you said, those narratives stick with you. And one of the things Lou Bergoux said about his book was he wanted, when I asked him, like, why write a book length treatment of this? At this point, when you go back to the newspaper coverage, it's not accurate.
Correct.
And so you can't, if you just go into the archive, so he felt strongly and the families felt there needed to be something that explained the full case, but that also had the ending. Because otherwise, if you read just one thing, you will never know.
That's so true. It's awful.
It's heartbreaking.
It's so awful. And there is a part in the book where I just wish we got to know the girls more. And I just feel so bummed out about that. And it's like, but that's the point, right? Like, they didn't even get to live a life. Like, they were kids, you know?
Yeah.
And they're just kids bopping around doing kids things. And it's sad. It's unfortunate. But then for such a big portion of the book, we're talking about this other family and how bad somebody is and why this and that. And it's just, the girls get so lost in that period of the book. And it's like, oh my gosh. And that was such a great example of what we're talking about, though, because the girls did get lost. It's like, this is really supposed to be about them. Wait a second. Like, let's go back. Let's make it really about them and make sure we're investigating the right thing, like making sure that things are really connected and not just happenstance or ideas or opinions. Not that there can't be facts that come from that too, but when you're giving like so much credence to it, it's a little scary.
I think, again, the other thing I want to leave listeners with today is just when everybody reads the same book, this is a Sioux Land book. There's also the South Dakota One book right now. Other communities have, you know, everybody in the community is reading the same book. And then you get to have all these conversations like we're having now. People say, can you believe that this happened? And there become lessons. And it's about history. It's a story from fairly recent history, but it's a historical tale. That's podcaster and local historian Lori Kent. otherwise known as Local Lou. You can check out her presentation called The Court of Public Opinion this Saturday, 10 a.m. in the Downtown Library in Sioux Falls. Also presenting at the One Book Siouxland Kickoff is award-winning artist Jerry Fogg. He'll talk about his art and missing and murdered Indigenous women. There's also a journalist panel discussing crime reporting in the state. You can find out more about the event on the Siouxland Library website. Well, before we wrap up today's show, this is a reminder that we are in the middle of SDPB's Spring Member Drive, and stopping by the studio, we have In the Moment producer Ellen Kester. Hey, Ellen.
Hello, Lori.
On public radio, you hear stories and conversations that we hope here at In the Moment will make you stop and think, sometimes even change your view of your neighborhood, of South Dakota, of the world. And today we are pulling back the curtain a bit to give you a look at how these stories come to the air, brought to you by South Dakota journalists like Ellen. Ellen, is you worked on this hour, and especially when you got the tape back from me after I had done the interviews and you were working through editing and talking with Ari about how things were going to come together. Mm-hmm. Was there anything that stood out to you?
I mean, Local Lou is just absolutely fantastic, who you just heard on the show today. She is one of, like, the, she comes up with the funniest ways of saying things, the most intriguing ways of saying things, and just her overall conversation today, which, again, you just heard. You don't need me to go through
that
it
enthusiasm.
Again.
We're all thinking the same thing. We're all thinking that
yes.
We love Lou. Yeah. One of the other things we like to do then is when the show is over, it's not over.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, from a post-production standpoint, it's not over. You have a lot more work to do.
Web post, podcast,
yeah. Instagram,
social media.
Yeah, social media. But also the conversation isn't over. So what are you thinking are some ways we can move this conversation forward in the future?
Well, we're thinking a lot of things, and I think we do kind of want to keep it a little behind the scenes. Apologies, listeners. But the true crime is something that is just so huge in our media landscape, mm-hmm. and it's often not done super well. So we're talking with people who here in our hometown, in our home state, who are doing it thoughtfully, who are doing it well.
We don't all three of us don't always see eye to eye on true crime.
Yes.
And that creates some very interesting conversations around the newsroom that mm-hmm. I think serve listeners at the end of the day. One of the things I would like people to come away with today is how much we go back and forth with how mm-hmm. a show should end up on the air. And we do it really fast.
Yeah, we do with these very, very complex issues that have multiple different perspectives, and we try to bring all of those perspectives in to an hour.
Yeah.
So like with today's show, we're probably going to have to do a second hour.
There might be more to come.
There might be more to come. Who knows?
All right. And
Tune in.
And you support that more to come. You support In the Moment. We thank you for that. If you want to be part of Friends of SDPB, call in with a donation today. Call 605-443-6963 or go online, sdpb.org. So this has been a particularly intense hour, and before we close the show, I wanted to let you know it's been intense even for me. I had a dream last night about Pam Jackson and Sherry Miller. Specifically, I dreamt about one of their hands submerged in muddy water, clutching at the inside door handle of a Studebaker. I woke up clutching my own throat. In 1971, two young women disappeared. Outside family members, hardly anyone looked for them. No one looked for them in the right place. Maybe they ran away, the families were told. Girls run away. They join communes. They join cults. They meet men. They meet pimps. The families were told there was nothing anybody could do but pray and wait. Vanished in Vermilion is the story of vulnerable women. First, the women who disappeared. Then, later in the book, women who were damaged but not destroyed by a man they were trying to leave, but who would not accept the fact that relationships end. Those women testified in court about their most terrifying days. They told their stories again and again as they sought justice. There's also a woman in her 80s in this book, the mother of a convicted felon. Everyone in prison is somebody's child, after all. The elderly woman's garden was torn up by investigators looking for bodies that were never there. There's also a sister struggling with memories, many of which turn out not to be real. Memories she solidified under the guidance of law enforcement officers who were looking for evidence of a crime that in the end didn't actually happen. Today, on the South Dakota Attorney General's Missing Persons website, 108 people are missing. 57% of them are women. There are twice as many Native American women missing as white women missing. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us at SDPB, thank you for listening.